Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Alex Golub, and I'll be the host of the channel today. Today, we're going to be talking to Maile Arvin, who is the author of Possessing Polynesians, The Science of Settler Colonial Whiteness in Hawaii and Oceania. So, Maile, thanks so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, this book is very broad. It covers all over the world and a pretty long time period as well. Can you tell me how it is that you came to write this book? What is the story behind the book?
Sure. It's my pleasure. My book came about, it has a couple different origin stories. I guess one of them is that I'm Native Hawaiian and I always grew up learning or trying to figure out all the issues around blood quantum that were manifest in my family. And my mom grew up on a homestead in Waimanalo, Hawaii. And, as I got older and started to understand the different restrictions about who can have a homestead, how it could be passed down, and kind of saw all many of the ways that that put a lot of different pressures on my family, I just became really interested in the history of blood quantum as it affected Native Hawaiians. As I got into grad school, while I was in grad school, Kehaulani Kawanui's book, Hawaiian Blood, came out, and that provides a really important and crucial legal history of the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act and the ways that blood quantum and the 50% blood quantum requirement became attached to being able to lease a homestead in Hawaii. But even as that book has been really important to me, I was still left with a lot of questions about like where blood quantum came from, like intellectually or in the history of science. And so that's one way I came to write this book is kind of from a deeply personal reckoning with blood quantum issues. But then also another genealogy is that in graduate school, one of my advisors was Denise Da Silva, and she is a very accomplished scholar of race, and her book Towards a Global Idea of Race does a lot of excavation of European philosophy and social science. And so it's kind of through working with her and learning from her work it made me kind of not dismiss some of the older texts that I encountered where things about Polynesians were being written down and the Polynesian race was being described by white social scientists. That's where the book bubbled up from.
I guess some people would be tempted to say, well, this 19th century racial theory, that was then, but now we know better. And now social scientists and others don't do that anymore. But your book shows that there's a lot of consistency and continuity between those works that some people might think outdated and contemporary projects like Genetics.
Yeah, absolutely. And my book is really broad. And I think sometimes maybe historians in particular kind of question like the scope of it. For some historians who are more used to kind of dealing like with in detail with very discrete historical periods. But my training is in ethnic studies, which is, you know, an interdisciplinary field. And, you know, maybe because, you know, as I said, a lot of my interest in this topic is personal or, you know, tied to my political commitments as a Native Hawaiian person. And so to me, it was really important to not just look at these historical scientific studies, like, and then be like, okay, that was then, and that was unfortunate, but we've moved on. But instead, really try to grapple with the ways that the logic that was produced in this older racial science still continues to be very much alive for and have real consequences for Native Hawaiian and other Indigenous people. And so my argument isn't that, like, all the things that, you know, a eugenicist would have believed in the 1920s is exactly the same as, you know, what's accepted in anthropology today, of course, but that even as anthropology and other social sciences have, you know, disavowed many of the more explicitly racist ideologies, that a lot of the maybe more nuanced or complicated ideas that were produced in the older racial science continues to go uncontested. And so that's kind of what I'm trying to get at in the broad scope of the book.
One of the things that I liked about the book was the way in which you showed that there were continuities through transformation, that even as these fields changed, there you could still find things that had sort of stayed the same. And for people who haven't had a chance to read the book, there's discussions of Hawaiians as a beautiful race of people who have sort of mixed in this way. You can probably imitate these guys a lot better than me. From Spencer Wells, a geneticist, I guess, from the 20th century. And then you also find these other texts from much, much early. And some of the sentences are like exactly the same. I mean, it's really not a stretch to see that even if their explicit scientific content may have shifted, that a lot of the attitude and the context, I mean, it's really remarkable how it jumps out at you.
Yeah, thanks. I think that's what I hope the book does, is kind of allows people to see some of those continuities that we wouldn't really expect them to be so blatantly similar, but they are, and it's disturbing, right?
Yeah, it's quite something. Yeah. As a settler living in Hawaii, I think a lot about these issues, and it is sometimes remarkable to see this discourse pop up in all kinds of places. I'm sorry, go ahead. We're going to say something.
Oh no. Yeah. Just kind of affirming and, you know, recognizing your experience.
So the title of the book is Possessing Polynesians. And you talk about this mechanism or this trope that circulates in all of this literature called whiteness by possession. Or can you tell me a little bit about what possessing Polynesians means and what this concept of possessive whiteness is? This is not a book about explicit chattel slavery. So possessing Polynesians, that's something slightly more complicated than just physically owning people.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. The concept is, it does come out of the history of social science and the ways that white social scientists wrote about Indigenous people of the Pacific from really some of the earliest encounters between Europeans and Indigenous Pacific Islanders. And it really all goes back to the ways that Europeans, early European so-called explorers, when they encountered the Pacific and Pacific peoples, there gradually became to build up this representation of Polynesians as almost white. That was in very clear distinction to Melanesians, who were in the eyes of Europeans, black. And that's as many anthropologists of the Pacific know, that's reflected in the name of Melanesia, which Mela means black, right? And so my book, the first half of the book, really grapples with that the history of that racial split that Europeans saw in the Pacific, and the idea of possession through whiteness that I develop throughout the book. It's really trying to grapple with the ways that European, like being placed in proximity to whiteness by Europeans, was not like a liberatory thing, right? Even as it's not the same as kind of sometimes the more explicit racism towards Melanesian people, but the proximity to whiteness that European settlers developed into this logic in Polynesia was a way for them to say that there was some kind of relationship or affinity between white settlers and Polynesian people. And many times that logic would be developed in such a way that it allowed white settlers to claim their own kind of indigeneity to Polynesia, because in this somewhat twisted logic, if Polynesians were white, or through the various different social scientists, some claim that Polynesians were ancestrally Aryan, like they had come from northern India, they had gone east from northern India, whereas Europeans had gone west, and so therefore there was some like very distant, real ancestry that Europeans and Polynesians shared, or later physical anthropologists would kind of measure physical features of Polynesians and compare them to other races, and based on those comparisons claim that that Polynesians were like almost like so close, almost Caucasian, right? And so and all those kind of twisted logics about placing Polynesians in proximity to whiteness, what I'm arguing is that it wasn't just kind of a softer racism or anything. It was actually a really important logic to settler colonialism, because again, it allowed white people in Polynesia to kind of stake their own forms of belonging to Polynesian land, Polynesian resources, and even to some extent Polynesian identity. And so that's basically the idea behind possession through whiteness. And what I try to do is excavate how that logic developed in the social science, but then in the second half of the book, look at how that logic kind of continues to operate today, even if in different forms.
So can you give me an example from the book of how it is that Polynesians being almost white sort of turned white people Polynesian? It's a kind of a logical move, which I think might seem unintuitive to some people. Can you maybe give us a concrete example to help flesh that out a little bit?
Sure. Let's see. So I'm trying to think of a really good one.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh yeah. In the first chapter, one of the writers that I look at, John Dunmore Lang, he talks a lot about how Polynesians kind of used to be this grand civilization, but that they had kind of degenerated from their heights, and that and through that kind of description of Polynesians, he he really evoked ancient Greece and Rome and even Egypt. And so, if people are probably familiar today with how kind of Greek mythology or Roman mythology is kind of seen as this heritage of Europe, even though, at the time that the Roman and Greek empires were powerful, they were fighting powers in Europe, right? So other powers in Europe. And so there's a way that sometimes Europeans could kind of appropriate other people's histories as their own, even if the actual lineage was not that clear, right? And so what I'm arguing is that people like Lang were doing the same with Polynesians. And he even would argue that Polynesians might have been ancient Romans who had traveled west, right? And so in the same way that some Europeans might see like Greek mythology as part of their heritage, even if they're not Greek, that was kind of a similar thing that at least early white settlers in the Pacific were also claiming in terms of Polynesia. Is that a helpful example?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you think about people living in Britain or France who think of there being, or America or anywhere, but just to keep the target on Europe, they're not actually from the Middle East, but they think of themselves as the inheritors of a Jewish tradition and then a Christian tradition, even though really, I mean, they're not from that place. They consider it to be part of their heritage, and they've built a historical narrative about how all the stuff that happened over there was kind of leading up to them. And I guess in the same way, settlers who move to Aotearoa, New Zealand or Hawaii can see themselves as sort of the next stage of history, maybe like in a better position to preserve Hawaiian culture than Hawaiians themselves could. I feel like maybe that's something I've heard people say, the missionaries could preserve Hawaiian culture through writing in a way that Hawaiians couldn't, maybe something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly what a lot of these early white settlers were saying, right? That it wasn't that they came to Polynesia and were immediately, wowed by the civilization there, right? Because they didn't consider Hawaiians or other Polynesians civilized exactly, right? And so what they were saying is that, well, you're not really civilized, but because we might share this ancient lineage, we kind of see you as redeemable. And we hope that through white settlement of the Pacific that, we're going to help bring you back up into the heights of civilization that your ancient ancestors might have once known, right? The idea of Polynesians being somewhat white, it was never, even as it might be a little more complicated than explicit racism, it was certainly racist, right? It was certainly, it was a kind of convoluted logic, but it allowed white settlers to dismiss like actual indigenous people at the time, but kind of drawn this larger ancient history to justify their own settlement.
Yeah, I guess the downside of being labeled Melanesian was that you were sort of considered permanently uncivilizable for quite a good period of time. I mean, that's not right. True. There were also missionary endeavors over there, but there was a lot of explicit racism and race separation. Whereas, I guess some people might think, well, the good news for Polynesians is they're close enough to white people that they get to become like white people. But then many Polynesians would probably say, actually, we don't really necessarily see that as good news, right? There's downsides to that as well.
Exactly. And I think it's even a little more complicated than that. And I'm not a scholar of Melanesia. Folks like you would probably have a lot more depth and understanding of all the nuances there. But I do think it's so important to know about the ways that the idea of a white Polynesia was absolutely formed in distinction to a black Melanesia. The ways that this idea of possession through whiteness, anti-blackness was always a really important part of it. Even if white settlers had this idea that Polynesians were kind of white or could be white, there was always, that ideology was always, you know, shaped in really important ways by an anti-blackness that would allow white settlers to be anti-black towards Polynesians too, because that, again, the idea was that, like, oh, maybe your ancient ancestors were white, but like you today, the Polynesian person I'm looking at, you're black, right? And so that still allowed a lot of explicit racism towards Polynesians as well. But I think it's so important to, I think sometimes our theories of colonialism and decolonization haven't always grappled enough with just the kind of nuances and complications of white supremacy and anti-blackness. And so I hope my book is, helping to start scholars who work on the Pacific to think a little more deeply and to give us more nuanced understandings of how those things work out.
Yeah, you make that point in the book multiple times, and I appreciated it. It's useful to be reminded of how anti-Black racism is at play in Hawaii or other Pacific islands, even if there are not a lot of Black people to be the subject to that racism, that it's still always there in the background. And in the Commonwealth, it takes a slightly different form, but in Hawaii, which a lot of the chapters are about, I think you really make a valuable point that even though African-Americans might not be there, all of the debates and all of the discussion are constantly being had with reference to things that are happening on the mainland, and that anti-blackness is essentially a part of it. It's difficult to see when you live in a place where you don't see what's going on in the mainland. You don't have a sense of how that history has affected you.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it kind of helps explain, maybe one example that I use a lot, especially when I'm teaching undergrads, is the Hawaiian monarchy, in some ways, they were really recognizably modern, right? And they did a lot to shape Hawaii as a modern nation state and get it recognized by other European powers. And in some ways, that recognition was not unrelated to the ideas that Europeans had about Polynesians being almost white, right? And we could talk a little bit more about Kalakaua in relation to that. But I talked to my undergrads about that, but I also talked to them about the many, many racist political cartoons that were published about Kalakaua and Liliuokalani, in the lead up to the overthrow and during the annexation, where Kalakaua and Liliuokalani are, very explicitly depicted as with all the tropes of pickaninnies, or they're often have like feathers that are likening them to Native Americans, and so the thing is that the anti-blackness is always there, right? And so I think what generated over a century of a lot of social scientists being so fascinated with this idea that Polynesians could be white or were used to be white. It was really generated in some ways, I think, by this anxiety over whether Indigenous people in the Pacific were white or Black, right? I think that really comes to the surface when you see, on the one hand, the Hawaiian monarchy doing everything in its power to, you know, adopt the dress and mannerisms of, you know, European monarchs. And then at the very same time, you know, that was never enough for certain white viewers who, you know, would always see them as uncivilized heathens, you know, unfit to rule.
You know, so can I ask you a little bit about this? There have been some scholars who have argued that we overlook the role of rank and class in 19th century colonialism. So David Cannadine, for example, has this book called Ornamentalism, where he talks about the way in which European royalty were happy to recognize monarchs from foreign countries as monarchs, as royalty, sort of possibly regardless of their racial status. Or I think it's Brian Richardson who wrote Longitude and Empire, who says when Cook was exploring, he would sort of get off of the boat and say, take me to your leader. And if people mm-hmm. had a leader, then he was like, okay, you guys are now officially on this rung of civilization. And Cannadine has this story about, I guess it's Kamehameha II visiting London and going to a dinner with the Prince of Wales and being sitting right next to the prince. And then I guess one of the prince's Prussian relatives, I might be the future Wilhelm II, I forget, objects and says, why are you seating this guy from Hawaii at the place of honor? And the prince says, well, he's a king and you're just a prince. And so therefore he should be sitting here. And if he's not a king, then he's just an N-word. And so then obviously shouldn't even be in the room. So there is this weird, the story is quite a bit more graphic in the original telling. Sure. But there's a sense in which people were kind of happy to deal with rank. But then also there was this racial logic that sort of disqualified people. Do you think, I always worry as an American that we think too much about race. On the one hand, it's sort of impossible as an American to not think enough about it. I mean, it's not a minor factor in our history. But working with my Australian colleagues and some other colleagues in other countries, I always sort of think, you know, are we missing class a little bit here too when it comes to how these people were thinking about these things? I don't know. You don't have to have an answer for that. It's something that I often think about.
Sure. I guess I would argue that, you know, I don't think any of us thinks about race enough. I just think there's so much, at least, you know, in mainstream America, but also in every country in the world, where issues are clearly racial, but a lot of people don't recognize it or don't have the language to analyze it and critique it. And so I do think sometimes the way that race is analyzed in the U.S. can be limiting, and it's not appropriate to kind of export the kind of sometimes bounded ways that people talk about race as within the U.S. to other places where there's a different context, right? But I think my book tries to argue kind of really deeply that issues of anti-Blackness are global, right? And you know, I think that's clear in a lot of ways, but especially because of the source materials that I looked at in the historical social science that is really placing Hawaii within this larger, within Polynesia for one, but within the Pacific and kind of the global European imaginary about non-European people. And so I do think sometimes Hawaii, when we only try to understand Hawaii through an American racial lens with sometimes they're kind of referred to as like the four food groups of African Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans, and Latinx people. I mean, that food group model is kind of roundly critiqued in ethnic studies for good reason. What I hope my book does is really show how, you know, how inappropriate that model is for Hawaii in particular, because Hawaii is, you know, always the ideas about race that colonialism brought to Hawaii were always more global than just an American one.
One of the things that you talk about is the way in which Pacific Islanders can internalize these views about race in a lot of ways and how they deal with them. And that's, I feel like that's kind of the second half of the book. So maybe can you tell me a little bit about that? I certainly know that in the study of sort of the Polynesia Melanesia distinction, a couple of authors have written in the way about the way in which this anti-Black racism can make Polynesians look down on Melanesians as less civilized and less white. I've certainly experienced that at different points in my career myself. Can you tell me a little bit about what's going on with how people get those models inside of them and become kind of possessed by them?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's a really important function or process of colonialism, right? In a lot of different contexts, is that it's not just that it imposes this racial hierarchy on people, but it actually, you know, gets people to buy into it even when the hierarchy is stacked against themselves. And so I think that's one of the most insidious and therefore sometimes the hardest parts of colonialism to decolonize. And I think that's why a lot of scholars in Indigenous studies, you know, write so much and urgently about things like the history of boarding schools and, you know, other really violent projects of assimilation that that were devastating in a lot of ways. But one of the ways is that it kind of inculcated colonial ideas into Native people themselves. And and so my book, I try to deal with the very complicated nature of that by looking at a couple different cases. So for example, to go back to talking about blood quantum, one of the chapters in the second half of the book looks at this legal case where a group of five Native Hawaiian men sued the state, alleging that the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, a couple of their programs were benefiting Native Hawaiians who didn't have a 50% blood quantum, right? And so, and we don't have to get into all the legal details of the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, but basically they were, they claimed that they and their families had 50% or more, and that their interests were being diluted by the Office of Hawaiian Affairs allowing Native Hawaiians who didn't have that much blood quantum to benefit from their programs. And so I think that's, for me, that's just like one example of the ways that this kind of racial thinking about blood quantum gets internalized within our communities is, which can be really devastating to see, right? For many reasons, but because in a lot of, maybe most Native Hawaiian families, you know, people have different blood quantums, right? Because it's this made up metric anyway, but when people kind of double down on that, that as a hallmark of how Hawaiian you are, it's really devastating because you can see within families, it divides them, right? And I think, again, what I try to talk about with that case in the book is that, you know, it's not just like these individual men who are mean and bad, right? But that this is kind of how colonialism works. And in particular, this is how that idea of possession through whiteness works, is that people buy into it and perpetuate it. And I think what's important is aiming to critique those men, but to not only critique those men, but to critique the larger system that allows blood quantum to remain in place. And so, yeah, that's one example that I talk about.
So in this case, just to spell it out for people, I'm always afraid when I talk about stuff that's got to do with Hawaii or my specialty, I kind of slip into inside baseball here. So the Office of Hawaiian Affairs is basically a government organ for distributing, I think Kauanui calls it like racialized welfare. If you have a certain amount of so-called Hawaiian blood, then you are entitled to one level of benefit. And then if you have more over what they call 50% Hawaiian blood, is that right? Then you're entitled to an additional level of benefits. And all of this, I mean, one of the great ironies of this blood quantum idea is that you cannot actually check anyone's blood for Hawaiianness, because it doesn't have any, there's no biological basis for this. There's no Hawaiian particle in people's blood. So, right. I mean, this will drive me nuts. I will talk about it. It's such terrible social science.
Amend that. So the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, they were set up as part of the, when Hawaii became a state, and there was a new constitutional convention, I believe in the 70s, and there was some recognition that the state had some obligations to, take care of Native Hawaiians, because a lot of the land that formerly belonged to the Hawaiian monarchy, had been seized by the men who overthrew the Hawaiian kingdom and then ran the territory of Hawaii. And then, with statehood, there was some recognition that the state government had an obligation to do more to serve Native Hawaiians. And that's what that office is supposed to do. Because of this different legislation from 1920, the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, that's the act that enshrined the blood quantum, that it says, officially it says, Hawaiians should have no less than one half part. And so that kind of more informally has become 50%. But partly, and so those men who sued OHA because they alleged that they weren't serving only Native Hawaiians with the proper blood quantum, their case was actually dismissed because OHA didn't, legally they didn't actually have to only serve people with 50% blood quantum. It's only the Hawaiian homesteads. Things that are relating to the Hawaiian homesteads that requires blood quantum in that way. That might be getting too much into the weeds, but I'm just...
Well, yeah, I think it's...
To get at some I think of the complications.
It's worth pointing out that this is another one of these examples where you make where the government is kind of giving in one sense, but then in order to receive, you have to buy into a form of knowledge which in a more fundamental way gives epistemic authority to biologists and scientists, right? Or a sort of Western frame of biology. And that's sort of the key point. It looks like a form of reconciliation or social justice, but it's based on these deeper epistemic sets of issues which are undemocratic in that they don't give Hawaiians a chance to define themselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And in this case, even though these men were their suit was not successful. The thing, and tell me if I'm wrong here. The issue is not that they're bad people or they're mean-hearted, but they had internalized this model of what counts as Hawaiian, which got to the point where they were suing other Hawaiians for not having the right amount of blood. And that the fact that they had internalized that framework, that's what's so distressing, right?
Yeah. And I think it also just kind of shows that, you know, Native Hawaiians don't have a lot of avenues in which to, you know, decide these like membership requirements on their own terms, right? And so I think another reason why they were suing the Office of Hawaiian Affairs is just like to, you know, try to like take some control over the ways that the state, you know, imposes blood quantum. But yeah, the way that they did it was kind of just doubled down on the violence of blood quantum. But mm-hmm. But I think to me, it's also important to kind of notice that also the state didn't decide to like do away with blood quantum, right? So they're still the arbiter of blood quantum. And that, you know, and so, yeah, just it shows that kind of our efforts at decolonization have to be so multifaceted, right? They have to be able to deal with like these real legal problems, but also address the ways that our own people in our own communities, you know, have internalized these really problematic ideas. And I think especially coming from like a Indigenous feminist perspective, it's really important that, you know, whatever forms of decolonization that we're working towards do not include these, you know, heteropatriarchal and racist ideas of who we are.
Right. And you talk a lot in this book about this concept of regenerative refusal as a way of doing that. Can you tell me a little bit about what regenerative refusal is and how it's sort of a way forward possibly?
Yeah, sure. So in the book, I talk about regenerative refusal as just a kind of a way to recognize and analyze some of the actions that Native Hawaiians and other Polynesians and other Indigenous people take, you know, to try to, you know, both kind of stop colonialism and enact something different. And so in that chapter that I look at those men who sued the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, you know, I analyze what they did, but then I also analyze the testimonies of other Native Hawaiians who spoke in 2014 during these hearings that the federal government held about the possibility of federally recognizing Native Hawaiians. And that's kind of a whole other quagmire to explain. But basically, Native Hawaiians, until this process started, were not like understood legally in the same terms as some Native American tribes who have federal recognition and therefore have might have a tribal government and a tribal reservation. And so some Native Hawaiians had for a long time pushed to have their status be more equal to Native American federally recognized tribes. And so in 2014, the Department of Interior came and held these hearings with the public to ask if Native Hawaiians wanted federal recognition. And at almost every hearing, like over, by my understanding, at least like 90% of the Native Hawaiians who spoke said, no, we don't want federal recognition. Like, you should go back to Washington and send the Department of State, because Native Hawaiians, you know, have a right to their own nation, and we don't want to be recognized as a nation within a nation. And you know, the testimonies, they're really moving and complex. And so I look at just a couple of them that talk more explicitly about blood quantum as kind of a foil to the ways that blood quantum was invoked in that legal case. And so I think what those testimonies do is that they're regenerative refusals, in the sense that, you know, they're very clearly saying no to the kinds of recognition that the state was offering to Native Hawaiians, but that they're also kind of opening up the space for Native Hawaiians to think differently and think about what they wanted, right? And not just, and so it's the no, I think in a lot of the popular mainstream coverage of those hearings in 2014, the news people were often like, oh, Native Hawaiians are so mean and like they're being so rude to these Department of Interior officials. And I think that was a real shame. I mean, that was kind of a racist coverage of the testimonies. But also, I think it really missed the ways that people were, you know, theorizing and enacting the kinds of nationhood that they wanted, right? And so it's not, so to me, regenerative refusals was just a kind of analytic way to point out that often when Native people say no to something, they're understood as being ungrateful or unruly or, you know, unintelligent, because they seem to be opting out of something that, even if it's kind of recognizably not the perfect solution, other more moderates might say, well, this is the best that you can get. So, you know, how can you say no to this? And so, but I think, you know, especially those testimonies show the no is opening up this whole different world for people, right? It's, and it's might not be recognizable in terms of the state. But I think, yeah, I guess that's, for me, it was really important to try to show that like, no is never just, you know, a disengagement. It's actually a different form of engagement.
Yeah, I guess a lot of people would maybe look at someone saying, oh, we don't want to be federally recognized. We want to restore the monarchy or restore the Hawaiian kingdom. A lot of people would say, you know, you're crazy. You're an extremist. That's not effective politics. Real politics is working within this system to get what you can in situations when it's possible and then keep pushing. But we're not going to have a monarchy that's a pipe dream, you know, but, mm-hmm. but you're saying that actually in that moment of saying, no, we don't want to play this game, people are creating another form of life, another way of being, which is full of different, I want to start dripping into technical language here. It has a different feeling, a spatiotemporal feeling, a set of affects and a set of qualities, which is itself sort of a new and empowering way of being, something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And and I think, you know, there are many Native Hawaiians who are of that more pragmatic mind, right? And who argue that, federal recognition, which actually, you know, did pass 2 years later, despite the kind of overwhelming protest of many of the people who spoke at those hearings. Many Native Hawaiians still kind of celebrated that that federal recognition precisely because they thought, or maybe still think, that pragmatically that's the best we can get, and that they wanted to see something within their lifetime that would bring some measure of justice, right? And you know, I think that's understandable, right, in a lot of ways. But I think if that's the only discourse, you know, if that's the only kind of imagination that we're fostering within our community, then that's, you know, it's so impoverished, right, to only be able to think with the terms of the occupying state. And so, yeah, I think with those testimonies, even as ultimately they didn't change the outcome in terms of what the state did, they were still kind of really powerful points of connection for Native Hawaiian people. And I think we have seen similar points of connection and real hope and excitement in the ways that people have stood up to protect Mauna Kea as well. And that's another kind of flashpoint where some people, including some Native Hawaiians, think, you know, that it's a pipe dream to try to stop these powerful corporations from, you know, building the 30-meter telescope on Mauna Kea. But I think, you know, it's still not being built, and the forms of social and intellectual life that were fostered at Mauna Kea over the last year were so exciting and vital, and
I think I didn't at all read your book as a criticism of more mainstream politics, but well, I suppose it was critical of a lot, but not necessarily a critical of a sort of a more mainstream accommodationist Hawaiian politics, so much as insistence on recognizing as a form of politics and a positive project voices which might otherwise be considered marginal or safe to write off. And I thought that was very interesting, having met people from those communities. Many of them are working class. They haven't been to college. They're not good at performing with a certain kind of cultural capital that some other people might be better at performing at. I thought being able to describe that in a way that is accessible to sort of the highbrow types was very useful.
Thanks.
Yeah. So I could talk a lot more about this and Mauna Kea. Maybe we could talk just a little bit more about Mauna Kea, just a few more minutes before we wrap up. So this was a case in which the University of Hawaii, my employer, as well as other people, wanted to build a large telescope on top of a mountain, which many people believed was sacred. That's the short version of it. And there was an occupation and a guardianship of the mountain. And we just had the 1-year anniversary, right?
Yeah, that's right. Of the most recent occupation, last year was kind of one of the flashpoints in the history of Mauna Kea. There was a lot of organizing also in 2015, but also going as far back as the 1960s and 70s when the first telescopes were built on Mauna Kea.
Right. Thank you for that correction. So this is the most in a history of protests in this regard. And so you see this as another example of regenerative refusal, and one which in this case shows the very positive potential, how this is not merely a project of creating a community in an otherwise occupied place, but this is something where that energy from that space of refusal actually has real strong sort of politics with a capital P, policy outcomes, in the sense that there's no telescope up there.
I mean, I should say, like, I'm not directly involved with the organizing at Mauna Kea, and there are a lot of really amazing Hawaiian scholars and activists who are more appropriate to talk about Mauna Kea, but I do mention Mauna Kea in my book, and this was before the most recent, you know, it was it had to be turned in before the most recent occupation that started last year. But I talk about it just because it kind of all the broader issues that I talk about in the book regarding science and possession and discourses about, you know, universality, where the presumption is always that so-called science, you know, benefits all mankind. That kind of discourse is so present with Mauna Kea, and it was so present in the historical social science studies that I looked at as well. And so, so I think what, you know, one of the many things we can learn from all the Kia'i or the protectors that have worked so tirelessly to defend Mauna Kea is that, you know, discourses proclaiming, you know, benefit to all people should always be a little suspect, right? Or a lot suspect. And the ways that Native Hawaiians are written out of who benefits from the telescope, you know, I think that a lot of the people involved with protecting Mauna Kea just have been so smart and eloquent and crucial in showing how, you know, the telescope would not actually benefit most people, even if it would have this huge benefit to some astronomers, right? But that it posed a threat to the water aquifer for the whole island of Hawaii. And so there are real environmental impacts that, you know, are irrespective of the actual cultural impacts for Native Hawaiians as well. And so, again, you know, I think what I try to get at in the book with the ideas of possession through whiteness is that, you know, white settlers are kind of a white mainstream. There's a really deep history to the ways that they claim belonging or claim control to places in Hawaii and other parts of Polynesia. And, you know, Native Hawaiians and other indigenous people, you know, since the invent of colonialism, have had to figure out ways to speak back to that kind of logic and to try to disrupt it or, you know, And I think that's the ways that the Kia'i at Mauna Kea have done so by, you know, insisting that protecting Mauna Kea is not just for Native Hawaiians, but for everyone. And especially in this last year, by, you know, setting up a whole community there where people could have healthcare, could be fed, could go to university, right? That they were holding classes, sometimes like, you know, very several classes a day. I think that was just like one kind of powerful example of, how Native Hawaiians were thinking differently and engaging in decolonization in a way that really disrupted a kind of white possessive logic of land.
Yeah, I was struck when the telescope was being built that one of the things I heard more than once was, well, Polynesians have always been astronomers. It's part of your ancient wayfaring tradition. And so your heritage is actually our heritage, and that's why we're building the telescope.
Right. And that, as we've talked about, that logic comes straight out of the, you know, the Aryan and eugenicist studies from the late 1800s and early 1900s. And so it's really that kind of claim, kind of appropriative claim, that is still, it's so kind of enraging to see how much life it still has today. Right.
Yeah. Well, and I think the value of the book is that it's kind of a book. It's a book about decolonization that has its focus on white people. Although there's actually quite a lot in the second half, and particularly we did not get a chance to talk about Pacific artists. But once you see that mechanism, then you can start seeing it crop up and up again. So you guys have always been astronomers, but I'm sure if you were to pick up an astronomy book, it would say astronomy is the perfect form of knowledge of the stars, and we don't do astrology or other imperfect forms, you know, imperfect cultural forms that we've replaced. So again, it's always that logic of acknowledging, but then also sort of adopting and then purifying.
Right. And I mean, for many reasons, that kind of logic is so enraging. But for another reason is just because it was as late as the 70s that many people in mainstream science or just mainstream culture believe that the Pacific had been settled by random drift and not by purposeful navigation by Polynesians. And so, to kind of see mainstream science like suddenly kind of recognize that Polynesians are astronomers for the purpose of allowing them to take over land in Polynesia. It's just, you know, it just kind of compounds the, we weren't astronomers until you need to, our land to build for astronomy.
Yeah, it also is a very, very selective, it's such an impoverished understanding of the incredible number of skills that voyagers need to have in order to make those voyagers. I mean, there's so much more than just astronomers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you for all of that and that last little bit on Mauna Kea. I've taken up a lot of your time, so I'm going to let you go. But can you tell me now that this book is out the door, do you have another project you're working on?
Yeah, I do. My second book is looking at the history of territorial institutions in Hawaii, mostly focusing on the care and discipline of children. And so I look at the history of the territorial, there was a school for girls and a school for boys, as well as some private institutions such as the Salvation Army also ran a school for girls and boys. And overall, I'm looking at the history of those institutions, which we're not exclusively caring for or disciplining Native Hawaiians, but Native Hawaiians were the majority of the populations at those institutions, along with a small number of Asian Americans. And so I'm interested in how, at both the state and private level, these institutions are were enacting, kind of a forced assimilation of Native Hawaiians as Hawaii became a territory and then a state. Very gendered ideas of what young Native Hawaiian men and women should be. I could go on, but maybe I'll just end with that.
Well, it sounds like a great project and an important one too. So I look forward to seeing it when it comes out. And thanks for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. It was a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you. I enjoyed it as well. Thanks, Alex.